Hello and welcome to Independent Thinking, the weekly podcast from Chatham House. I'm Bronwyn Maddox, the director, and I'm speaking to you today from Tokyo, having spent a week in Japan talking to people about the questions affecting this country, the region, and how those fit in with the world. Countries around here have been watching very closely the events in China this past week. Xi Jinping asserted his authority over the Communist Party at the National People's Congress. That's the enormous annual gathering of about 3,000 delegates. They meet in the Great Hall of the People in Tiananmen Square. They pass laws, approve decisions made higher up the party chain. It's a huge week-long political spectacle. And this year, much of the focus has been on China's struggling economy, though that wasn't quite the phrase used. Wang Yi, the country's foreign minister, has said China is open for business, but concerns about the property market and foreign investment and youth unemployment have not gone away. Indeed, the Congress opened with Premier Li Cheng announcing a 5% growth target. We can debate whether that is ambitious or not. Well, we're going to talk about that and what these decisions and these trends mean, not only for China, but for Japan. China is Japan's largest trading partner. And we'll look more broadly at the difficult relationship, as it sometimes is, between the two countries. We're also going to talk about the challenges posed by North Korea to Japan's security, indeed, to the world's security, if you like, and look at what impact a second Donald Trump presidency might have on ties between Japan and its most important security partner, the United States. Well, I've got a great panel joining me to delve into all that, a panel that is really spread around the world today. Joining me down the line from Taipei is Bethany Allen, Taiwan-based journalist and author of the book Beijing Rules. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us. You're just an hour distant from where I am in time zone. Joining us from London is Dr. Yu Jia, senior fellow with our Asia-Pacific program. Welcome.
Hello. Delighted to return to your podcast, Bronwyn.
I'm delighted to have you on what I would call our podcast, the Chatham House podcast, and joining us once again, also from London. In fact, the only one of us actually in Chatham House at the moment is Robert Ward, who is the Japan chair at the IISS, the International Institute for Strategic Studies. Welcome back.
Good morning from London, Bronwyn.
Great to have you here. All right, let's start with this spectacle that I was just talking about, the National People's Congress in Beijing this week. Yujia, I wonder if you could take us through the basics. What is this Congress and what role does it play in China?
Well, National People's Congress for Beijing every year is an annual gathering around 3,000 delegates, political elites, celebrities, and all sort of socialites across different walks of Chinese society. And in the 7 days of this convening, the government will decide what is the budget look like and what will be the economic priority for Beijing, as well as what are the core policy priorities too, including foreign affairs, including policy towards Taiwan, and also including, very interestingly, I think Robert would know this, how China's military spending will be designed. So these are the core things. It's like the combination of cabinet minister meeting plus together as a budget day, like in the UK.
I think you're still slightly underplaying the drama and the scale of this, but I take the point. You've seen quite a few of these. You've been a professional watcher of them over the years. What did you make of this one?
Well, speaking of drama, precisely this year has a very little drama to getting very excited. Perhaps the biggest surprise this year is the cancellation, the unexpected cancellation of Premier Li Qiang's press conference, which essentially broke a 30-year-long rule that Premier would meet the press after the end of the session. However, this year he has decided to remove that altogether, and by suggesting this is unlikely to convene at any time, any other next editions of MPC. So that is, for me, is the biggest surprise.
And we heard from journalists, they were told, they referred simply to the speech and said, well, it's all in there. Bethany, what does that tell you about Xi Jinping's control over the party right now?
Well, I think it's important to put this also within the context of the position of China's premier and the relative position of China's State Council. So, Li Qiang, as the premier of China, the premier is always the one who gives this press conference. For the first time in 30 years, it was canceled. The premier is also the head of the State Council, which is the equivalent of China's cabinet. It's a government organ as opposed to a party organ. And this year, one of the new laws passed by the National People's Congress was a law that strengthened control of the party over the State Council. This is much in line with what we have seen under Xi Jinping in the past 10 years, a further consolidation of Xi Jinping's own power, a weakening of the power of those around him, and getting rid of the group power, the sort of rule by consensus of the top elites that had previously guided China for the past 30 years, and also just a consolidation of the party's control over government and over every aspect of society. So this Congress was very much in line with that. So, you know, Li Qiang himself, his predecessor, Li Keqiang, was a powerful figure in his own right, and he wasn't, you know, Xi Jinping's protege. Li Qiang very much is. He was the party secretary of Shanghai during the infamous Shanghai lockdown, and Xi Jinping chose him. So innately, he has less of his own power base than his predecessor. This, you know, the fact that he did not give this press conference and the whole role of the State Council being lessened just is a further indicator that Xi has less and less tolerance or less and less desire for there to be any single person to compete, even in the public space, in the very scripted public eye for power, even among his own hand-selected protégés.
That is an extraordinary picture that you're giving us, many people have described, but this huge, complex country run increasingly by one man. Robert, what do you think the implications are of this?
Well, for the economy, not that good, I think. The target for growth next year, I think, is about 5%. Being an economist by sort of first love, I'm always looking for productivity in policy, whether there's measures to generate productivity growth. China, like the rest of us, has productivity issues, partly because the economy is maturing and partly because sort of softer kind of reforms need to be done. I didn't find much exciting in the policy speeches in this session. Xi Jinping, the government talks about innovation. Well, yes, China does innovate, but you also need other things in terms of regulatory loosening, some measures to boost consumption and so on. I didn't see much encouraging there. And this time, of course, little stimulus. There'll be some, probably, but you may have seen the reports in the press today about local governments having to sort of get their hair shirts on and cut spending. And this all suggests that the 5% growth target, I mean, they may get it officially, but it'll be quite difficult to achieve. I suspect that growth, sort of natural growth for China now is about 2 to 3%.
Which is, I was going to ask you whether 5% was a lot or a little. And you know, it's a little compared to some of the past growth rates we've had reported. Obviously, there's some room for China to move those figures around a bit. But is it enough, in your view, for it to satisfy the economic demands?
I think it's going to be difficult to get to that 5% target. I mean, part of this constant setting of targets, clearly there's a political message there as well for the government to achieve the China dream and doubling of incomes and all of that. But it is difficult. I think having looked at Japan since 1989, quite a long time now, the word Japanification is being used in context with China's economy. And that obviously interests me hugely, given that I've been through the Japanification process myself, so analytically rather.
Just take everyone into what Japanification means, because it's not a great thing for a country to say about itself, is it?
No, and of course, as you've been going since 1989, you'll also understand this, since the 80s rather, you'll also understand this, Bronwyn. Japanification, there's sort of some characteristics of Japanification, sort of overinvestment, which I think we see in bits of China, real estate market struggling, too much debt associated with the real estate market, aging population. And of course, when Japan's bubble burst, it wasn't aging as quickly as China is now. Local government debt, local governments, private sector, and so on. And of course, deflationary pressures. So these are all characteristics of Japanification. So you could say that China's got Japanification with Chinese characteristics. There are some differences. I mean, of course, China is a continental-sized economy, and Japan is relatively small. So China probably has some more growth left in it than Japan did in the early 1990s. But one of the big differences, I think, between China and Japan actually is sort of negative for China. And that is that it's not really well understood, I think, outside Japan. But in the 90s and early 2000s, Japan undertook some quite extensive political and institutional reforms, which helped it to deal eventually with problems in the financial sector and so on. and then set the path for recovery. And I think that's very unlikely in China, particularly given what Bethany and Yuji have been saying.
Thanks for that, I should say. I'm going to defer to you because I haven't quite been going since the 80s, but I certainly remember the many problems that flowed from that. Bethany, sitting in Taiwan, what did you make of this Congress? I'm thinking both of the economic points we're talking about, but also of the language about Taiwan.
Since Xi Jinping has been in power, and especially in the past 2 to 3 years, we have seen stronger language about Taiwan. Overall, I would say that it seemed as though Xi Jinping has taken the CCP's longstanding goal of taking Taiwan, of unifying with Taiwan, as an abstract theoretical goal for the future, and made it feel much more tangible, much more like something that it is Xi Jinping that actually plans to accomplish in one way or another. And certainly Taiwan was mentioned during the Congress. Now, the mention of the possibility of peaceful unification with Taiwan, that language was taken out. But I want to kind of add some extra analysis there, which is to say that that kind of language has been not used before. And so I don't want to overemphasize that we saw something particularly saber-rattling or especially concerning about Taiwan. I would say the language we saw is about consistent with what we have been seeing from China in the past few years. And to echo what Rob just said, there were very few specifics, really not much meaty substance of the economic plan that would assuage the concerns of foreign investors in China. At the end of last year, we saw foreign direct investment in China fall for the first time on record, for the first time in 30 years. And that's because, among other reasons, there has been this, extreme tightening of control and scrutiny over the operations of businesses in China, and particularly their dealings with the outside. So with the anti-espionage law, data protection laws, there are now laws against transferring information or data from China to outside of China. That sounds very vague. And indeed, it is very vague. People aren't sure what it means. And we have also seen Chinese authorities raid very prominent U.S. firms, including Mint and Bain, other auditing firms, and detain their employees. And this has really cast a chill, at least for the short term, over investing and some business opportunities.
And it's raised questions. I mean, officials have been told not to use Apple phones, haven't they? In case those pick up data, right. Tesla, there's questions about whether Tesla cars are picking up data and so on.
That's right. And so, we could have seen more specific carrots offered, or sort of olive branches offered for foreign businesses and for international trade, and we didn't see that. We saw top leaders say, including Li Qiang and Wang Yi, that China's open for business, but show me the receipts. What does that mean?
Yes, Yujia, what do you make of this? We're in a loop of conversation that is quite familiar to people talking about China. On the one hand, we get this language about Taiwan. I'm very glad that Bethany said, look, this isn't markedly more aggressive. Part of the challenge of all this is calibrating it in the right way. But we've got this language about Taiwan. We've got these economic problems we've been talking about, the weakness of the local government debts, the property debts, the youth unemployment, and so on. You've got now a slowing down of foreign investment or even a fall in it. What should we make of this? Is China weak at home in a way that its leaders are going to worry about? Is it likely to do something about Taiwan because of that?
I think there's one word which could really sum up this year's NPC, National Party People's Congress, which is a sense of being very subdued. Subdued in the sense that wasn't quite sure whether the economic target will be able to meet. And second number, which no one have picked up so far, is on this employment creation. Beijing suggested that it aimed to creating around 12 million in fresh graduate employment for 2024, which is the equivalent, exactly the same number Beijing put forward to back to 2019. When the Chinese economy grew around 8%. So for me, that sense of how much job creations can realistically Beijing is able to do by not relying on property sector, that's a big question mark.
Just to make the obvious arithmetic point, this is a million jobs a month in order to give people enough jobs.
In order to give people enough jobs and also in order to meet this 5% growth target. So that sense of being ambitious, but also being very subdued. I mean, as the other two speakers said, there isn't really much substance, if judging from the entire government report, which I've gone through line by line. I think part of the reason also because another very important convening, the third plenum of the 20th Party Congress, which seemed generally determine the economic direction of travel for China, has not really been convened at all. I mean, it should have been convened 5 months ago in November, but I think all the global investors are now waiting exactly where Xi Jinping wants to take this country forward. So that is really the sense of lack of clarity, I would say, really deter foreign investors. Then, of course, when it comes to geopolitical issues, when it comes to foreign affairs, 90 minutes long press conference by Wang Yi. I've watched out the entire session. I felt I could not pick up anything new there except the party ideological language is so heavily wrapped into China's foreign affairs priorities. So if I'm going to peel the onion in here, I think the three things which he mentioned will be the key for China's next year, for 2024, for foreign affairs. Firstly, on strengthening China's tie with global South countries. Secondly, being very proactive on multilateral international organization, assertively setting China's global governance agenda. And lastly, that China is very much keen to reconcile with Europe, given the hindsight of the likely return of President Donald Trump. So these are the three things. But Wang Yi spent 90 minutes, rubbed it all together with a very strong Chinese rhetoric. And it's very hard for international audience to understand. So, I mean, really, in terms of attracting investment or make China more attractive, they have to do some really basic groundwork to make international audience understand what exactly they're trying to do. And so far, I think that space is completely empty.
And even so, the picture that the three of you have put together is of a country increasingly run by one person with all the unpredictability that then follows. Let's move to the other possible single person source of unpredictability that Yujia just mentioned, and that's Donald Trump. Robert, I wonder if you could take us into what the implications might be of another Trump presidency, particularly for Japan, which you write a lot about.
Well, you're in Japan at the moment, Bronwyn, so you may have heard this wonderful neologism, which Japanese does this very well. You've got the kanji, you just stick them together, and it's moshitora. I don't know whether you've heard that in your discussions. Moshitora is a word, and it basically means what if Trump. What if, and Tora is the first two of the four katakana used for Trump. Tora also has a sort of play on words because Tora is tiger in Japanese as well. So there's a sort of little bit of wordplay going on. But what this Moshitora, I think, shows you is that it is a real live issue now in Japan. I mean, Moshitora, in a sense, expresses a state of mind as much as anything else, but also a kind of a view about what Japan needs to do in terms of its policy. Now, if Donald Trump does come back for a second term, clearly Japan lacks Abe Shinzo, who was the, in my view, the best, silkiest Trump whisperer in the G7, if not in the world. He has what I'm calling a sort of strategic charm that he exerted on Trump and managed to ensure that Japan managed to navigate the choppy waters pretty well, actually. So one of the concerns in Japan is that with no Abe Shinzo, on the scene, how does Japan, in personality terms, political personality terms, how does it manage this relationship? The sort of good news for Japan is there are some on the scene. One of whom I think is Aso Taro, who used to be, I think, Deputy Prime Minister and the long-term Finance Minister. So was around when Abe Shinzo was dealing with Trump. He's seen as someone that can perhaps smooth these relations. But in terms of what Japan is worrying about specifically, if Trump did come back, I think one of the things is, if you look in the very sort of close regional context, is the relationship with South Korea. Now, this, I think we talked about in the last podcast that we did, Bronwyn, the rapprochement between Japan and South Korea. This is really important for regional stability. Prime Minister Kishida and President Yoon in South Korea, they deserve a lot of credit for making this happen. But of course, the US sort of ties these together. And President Biden has also sort of worked hard to ensure that this is bearing fruit. Now, with Donald Trump, we know his view about alliances and so on is more transactional. So how would this important trilateral relationship, how would that develop? And the other issue, of course, is President Biden has spent a lot of time and strategic energy in building up sort of lattice work of relationships within the Indo-Pacific to sort of create strategic complexity in the region. That, of course, acts as a deterrent to China. So what would happen to that, for example, should Trump come back?
I'm indebted to you for bringing Moshi Tora into this conversation. I've not got into a conversation where Trump hasn't featured in some way, even in our purely commercial conversations, and people saying close to the government, look, we don't really have a plan B other. The relationship with the US is so much the cornerstone of our foreign policy. Though, as you said, there's a lattice work of relationships built up as well. Yujia, how destabilizing do you think it might be if we do have a Trump too?
Well, I mean, really, for China's perspective, there isn't really any good candidates for this upcoming election anyway. So by having Biden, they probably would double down the technological restrictions and what the government has continued to do anyway, than by having Trump. So, of course, on the one hand, as I said earlier, that it might be perhaps Beijing would have the opportunity to making some reconciliation, mediation with Europe, because Trump has already expressed his dissatisfaction with transatlantic alliances and also keep talking about withdrawing supporting from Ukraine. So that might be a window opportunity for Beijing. But however, I think that sense of unpredictability bring by President Trump and his team around him to making policies towards China, I think that would make Beijing feel very nervous about it. So in a way, Beijing would much prefer to deal with the certain devil, but does not really like any uncertainty. I mean, it's just the nature of the Communist Party regime. Really.
A certain devil of Joe Biden. That's not quite the phrases his campaign is using, but it does have a certain reliability about it. Bethany, what about the question of tariffs, which is one thing that Trump has said, and he does cast everything in this very transactional deal-making sort of language. But he said, look, lots of tariffs will come on the whole world, but particularly on imports from China. What's been the kind of thinking about that?
Yeah, so it's interesting that so far on the campaign trail, Trump hasn't really talked about China that much. You know, he likely will as we get closer to November. But what he has said, and you know, what reporting from those around him has made clear, is that, as you said, when it comes to China, tariffs is something that he really does have a strong opinion about at the moment. He has said that he will greatly increase tariffs on China up to maybe like 50% on many Chinese goods. Clearly, this is something that Xi Jinping is not excited about hearing. And it feels a little bit like 2016 again, where Trump is just railing about the same issues, about trade issues. And I think that that is important, because in Trump's first term, for the first year, he didn't really have a China policy. His whole team didn't really, there wasn't a Trump administration China policy, because there were, among other reasons, factional struggles within the administration. And to some extent, it's a little bit of a coincidence that the truly hawkish side won out. It could have been different. You know, Trump himself doesn't necessarily have very strong opinions about some aspects of China's challenges to U.S. national security, or to, at least as traditionally defined, or to the Western-led or U.S.-led world order. Trump, you know, likes dictators. He said fairly recently that he likes Xi Jinping. And there's, a window here. If I were Xi Jinping, I would try to give Trump some of what he wants in terms of tariffs and take it as a short-term pain to win Trump's goodwill and try to then be buddy-buddy with him. Because, I mean, Trump just recently said about TikTok, he doesn't view TikTok as the kind of threat that many analysts in the U.S. believe it to be. I think there's a big window of opportunity there for Xi on tariffs if he's willing to accede to some of Trump's demands.
That's a really, really interesting point you make. Robert, let's just swing around to South Korea, which you mentioned. And I also want to spend a few minutes just at the end on this question of North Korea's nuclear ambitions. But what about South Korea and Trump? I was in South Korea when Trump visited in his presidency, and he was ripping up the schedule and suddenly deciding to go north of the border in search of a deal, to the dismay of the South Koreans, who were really discomforted by the casualness with which he seemed to talk about this, again, relationship that for them has been absolutely central. Can you offer them any reassurance?
Rather than reassurance, I think there's a couple of issues to think about. I think reassurance might be not quite the right word. There are a couple of issues that I think are important for South Korea. And one, like Japan, South Korea is a security ally of the US, so a very important relationship. And this South Korea and Japan are sort of separate security allies of the US, so it's important that the three of them are able to work together. But there is a sort of undercurrent in South Korea of, does South Korea need to develop its own nuclear capabilities, nuclear weapons capability? And obviously, given the advances in North Korea in its nuclear weapons program, that's quite urgent. In some quarters, they feel it's quite urgent. I think one of the things to look for might be, given Trump's transactional view on alliances, as I've said before, and given the fears, perennial fears of the US allies in the region about being abandoned potentially by a more isolationist US. This predates Trump, of course. This is a perennial fear that these countries have. If Trump views this relationship with South Korea in purely transactional terms, if he's unpredictable with regard to North Korea, what does that do to this debate within South Korea about needing to develop its own nuclear weapons? And of course, if that happened, then that has a significant impact in the region and would obviously have an impact in Japan as well. Because then if you look to Japan's west, but all the countries in the west would be nuclear armed, and that all the from Russia in the north to China in the south, it's already quite a sort of complicated, strategically perilous sort of clutch of countries for Japan. So it doesn't want to see another nuclear state on its border.
No, but if it did, then the obvious question, does it want not to be left behind? Bethany, do you think that China feels it has control over North Korea? Clearly has some leverage in terms of supplying it with power and other goods. But is it in control of this country, this other strong leader with his constant threats, it feels like, about his weapons capability?
I don't think that that Beijing feels that way. They certainly have more leverage over North Korea and over the leadership there than any other country in the world. But what we don't see from Beijing is all that much of an attempt to wield that leverage, which suggests that it's capital that they don't want to expend. You know, they could be doing so much more, to pressure the regime there that they are not. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. And a key one is that, you know, what does it give them to be in that position? It gives them a lot of say or a lot of sway over South Korea, over the U.S. You know, we need them. If you talk with South Korean government officials who are very aligned with U.S. Human rights views or wish South Korea could come out more vocally in support of Taiwan, they'll say they can't because they need China. And that is a position that China loves to be in. You know, so I think that they're kind of, you know, sitting in between in this, taking advantage of the fact that they have some sway, but not control over Pyongyang.
That's fascinating. Eugenia, do you see it that way?
Which, you know what, if we come back to personal politics, if we all come back to everything down to Xi Jinping himself, one very interesting element we all may find in here, ever since Xi Jinping came to power back to 10 years ago, 11 years ago, there was never a state visit arranged between Beijing and Pyongyang. So either having Xi Jinping to go to Pyongyang or having Kim Jong-un came to Beijing as a state visit. The only time that the young Kim came to Beijing was the time when before he got to meet Donald Trump passing by Beijing. So it was never anything wholeheartedly that the two countries has much interest of arranging a state visit and show somehow the so-called lip and teeth relationship with each other. That's how Beijing put in the term defined. I think on the other hand, also Beijing feel quite wary these days regarding the ever closer ties between Pyongyang and Moscow. And particularly given the hindsight, both countries are sitting on China's border and both countries are nuclear powers. And if Beijing cannot handle that precarious balance very well, then surely it will become a diplomatic and strategic nightmare for Beijing as well. So I don't necessarily thinking that Beijing would have so much sway in terms of persuading North Korea. The North Korean might want to decide whatever they want to do. But I think this is also reflecting on a personal taste on the diplomacy for Xi Jinping himself, not really interested in dealing with anything to do with North Korea.
Really interesting. You've taken us very neatly back to the beginning. We are going to have to stop there. Our wonderful producer of this podcast, John Pollock, managed to find a half hour window between three time zones when we could all manage to make it. But that window is now closing. So huge thank you to my guests who've been wonderfully articulate and really kind of nuanced in calibrating these risks. And I've very much enjoyed that. Yujia, Bethany Allen, and Robert Ward. Do follow them all on X, on Twitter, whichever name you prefer. The details are in the show notes. And a reminder that you can find all of our podcasts on Apple, Spotify, all major platforms, as well as through our social media. Please do like, follow, and subscribe, and leave us a review. I do always ask. We do like to get them, whatever you say. To read more from our experts or to find out more about our events, don't forget to visit chathamhouse.org, and you can find our Asia Pacific program work there. Goodbye for me, Bronwyn Maddox in Japan. Until next time.